KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, two local authors, neuropsychologist Rick Hansen and philosophy professor Alvin Noe, have written about the brain and have brought in a good deal of neuroscience and exploration of mind and consciousness as well. In the case of Rick Hansen, Buddhist thought. And we'll explore all this in the hour ahead as both authors join us in studio for a wide-ranging discussion. It'll include your calls, your emails, and your online postings. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to Forum. Two Bay Area authors join us in studio this hour to talk about the human brain, mind, and consciousness. Rick Hansen is a neuropsychologist, neurophysiologist, and therapist who wrote a book called Buddha's Brain, which turns out to be a practical manual for helping us toward shaping our brains for a smarter, better, and fuller life. Rick Hansen co-founded Wellspring Institute and has been a board member of Spirit Rock Meditation Center. Writer and UC Berkeley philosophy professor Alvin Noe is the author of Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain, and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness. He's also a member of UC Berkeley's Institute of Cognitive and Brain Sciences. And both Alvin Noe and Rick Hansen join us in studio for this Forum Hour. And welcome, gentlemen. Good to have you both here.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And let me just say by way of introduction, well, actually, let me go to you first, if I may, Rick Hansen, because as I said, this is kind of a user's guide to the brain, and we're learning so much more about the brain through brain imaging and new technology like MRI, windows to the brain. But you're sort of saying here, you can change your brain. You can change your brain and change your life, literally.
Well, we've always have changed our brain. I mean, even just learning that 2 + 2 = 4 or being able to remember what we did last summer, for example, that involves brain change to be sure. But what the emerging opportunity is with neuroscience, which has essentially doubled in its knowledge base roughly in the last 20 years, informed, as I try to do it, through the contemplative traditions, which are these ancient traditions of people who've been, as some have said, the Olympic athletes of mental training in terms of working with their minds. The result of that increasingly is the opportunity, which is still in its infancy, but it's a very robust infancy. It's an opportunity for people to, in increasingly skillful and targeted ways, use mental activity alone to sculpt neural structure in ways that establish a growing neural substrate for positive mental states of happiness, love, and wisdom.
We can sculpt our neural structures.
Yes, indeed. Lots of research on that about how the flow of mental activity, that's what neuroplasticity is, and some of it's quite dramatic, as in when people who've had a major stroke recover speech function, for example, by building out other parts of the brain. But most neuroplasticity is pedestrian, but it's also very fundamental in the sense that the flow of thoughts and feelings going through the mind, which is to say going through the brain, that flow of information actually changes neural structure. For example, there are a number of studies that show things like taxicab drivers in London at the end of their training with the twisty-turny streets there actually have a thicker hippocampus, the part of the brain that's involved in visual spatial memory. Similarly, people who meditate routinely have thicker parts of the brain, for example, the anterior cingulate cortex, fancy word alert here, which is involved with controlling attention, as well as other parts of the brain that are involved with tuning into the body.
And you say the brain is like Velcro for negative experience and it's like Teflon for positive experience, so you can obviously kind of rewire your brain to think positively?
Yeah, that's a very fundamental point, which we may get into more deeply, which is that in evolution, while on the one hand it's very important to track carrots, if you will, in other words, pleasant experiences or opportunities, it's actually more important in terms of biological evolution for organisms to track threats, sticks, because if you fail to get a carrot today, you'll probably have a chance of one tomorrow. But if you fail to miss a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So the brain has acquired what's called a negativity bias. It tends to preferentially look for, store, and then retrieve negative experiences in what's called implicit memory rather than positive ones. We do remember million-dollar moments, but the brain, unfortunately, goes through its day holding on to negative experiences, even if most of a person's life is positive. So, unfortunately, I think the opportunity is to reverse that and through directed attention, focus on good facts and allow those to become good experiences as one way of building up positive resources inside, like resilience and self-confidence.
And here's Alvin Noe, who says, we aren't our brain. We are not our brain.
That's right. I mean, it's a sort of an interesting inheritance from sort of traditional philosophy that we are this thing inside us, which is supposedly is the seat of consciousness, the thing that thinks and feels and decides. John Donne said that no man is an island complete of itself. Contemporary cognitive neuroscience seems to say, no, it's exactly the case that every man is an island, radically cut off from the world around him or her. The body is a kind of information delivery system. The environment is a we know not what, a massive stimulation. Other people are just patterns in the stimulation. And then the aim of the neuroscience is to study the mind by just looking at what's going on inside of us. Now, what I think is that it's striking how little real traction we're getting on understanding how the mind works by just looking inside of us. And in part, that's because I think it's a mistake to think that the mind is inside us. The mind is rather something we do, something we achieve. We spend all our lives closely bound to other people, situated in environments, fully embodied, dynamically interactive with the world around us. And I think that ultimately, a satisfactory approach to the human mind is going to be a more holistic, more integrated one. And by the way, I actually think that Rick Hansen and I are very much in agreement about this. He's emphasizing, sorry, maybe you want controversy and sparks to fly here, but
not necessarily, but
the truth is, you know, once you have the more integrated perspective, you can then ask, well, what's the role that the brain plays in it all? And certainly the brain plays a critical role. The brain is necessary for human experience. But what I now think that scientific evidence as well as philosophy shows that it's wrong to think that the brain is sufficient for experience. You are not your brain. The brain is a part of you.
Well, I'm not trying to engender sparks necessarily, but I would say Rick takes a decidedly Buddhistic approach, and Buddhism would say your brain is not your mind. I mean, it's sort of a teaching of no self, isn't it? Which is, I guess, pretty much what you're saying, isn't it?
Well, I think in a way where, you know, where we ask where's the mind, and the traditional philosophical view and the contemporary orthodox scientific view as well, the mind is in the head. I think that's the wrong question. The mind doesn't have a location in that sense. It's not in the head, but it's not out of the head either. I think of the mind as a kind of complex of activity that we achieve, that we perform. And like everything else that we achieve and perform, we perform it in a context of relying on other people, relying on a landscape, relying on tools, relying on situations. I'm here to sort of defend John Donne. No man is an island. And in fact, we're deeply integrated with the world around us. And let me say another thing.
You don't have to defend John Donne on this program.
Well,
I've been a fan since God knows
okay,
how long.
Okay, yeah. Good. But I'm here to sort of to remember John Donne. But, you know, the thing is, Here's something I will say. Not only do I think this every person is an isolated island view is bad science, I also think it's a deeply sad conception of ourselves, this idea that each of us is sort of an alien in a strange land or stranger in a strange land, that we're sort of anthropologists trying to figure what's going on outside the limits of our skull, what's going on in the strange world of which we know nothing around us. And in that sense, part of what I'm trying to do is not only show that the science doesn't support this picture, but that the best science really supports a much more beautiful picture of ourselves as sort of at home in the world around us, of this world and at home in it. And I think that is a sort of more consoling view.
This is where you are in agreement. I mean,
exactly.
Rick writes a lot about empathy in his book, but does make a distinction of the brain being like a nervous system that's embedded in nature and culture, too. And the more information we get, the more we kind of swirl it around and convey meaning through it. But the mind is something I think you suggest in your book, and this is pretty much consistent with modern neuroscience, is what flows through. I mean, what allows these things to go through the nervous system and allow for change, including the connections we make with each other.
I think as a non-philosopher, one thing I've come to appreciate about these discussions is that it really helps to be very clear about the words we're using. So, for example, I try to define mind in the book in a very conservative way as the flow of information through the nervous system, most of which is forever unconscious. Now, that flow of information, including what Alvin Noe talks about in terms of mind as that which is in the domain of conscious experiencing, I think is best understood exactly as he has described it. In other words, as a process rather than a thing. And in particular, as I would emphasize, a functional process that has emerged over the course of 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system, because it conferred reproductive advantages, if you will, in terms of the engine of biological evolution. So as soon as one thinks about consciousness or conscious experiencing or the field of awareness and its contents as a functional process embedded in evolution, it immediately takes one into a respect for and an appreciation for and a kind of humility about the relationship between the organism and its whole natural world, and in particular for social animals like human beings, who are the most profoundly loving and social animals on the planet, as well as the cruelest.
More than puppies? Well. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. We're the most complex about it. Anyway, it takes you out into the functional benefits in relationships of conscious mental activity. Now, all that said, I do want to put a nod in for unconscious mental activity, because I think that's a lot of...
Because you're a psychotherapist.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of where the action is in terms of mental activity. But I think that there's a kind of grandiosity that I suspect Alva would agree with in presuming that we are our brains, you know, and that we are, and that the mind we have is entirely constructed within our own head. And I think there's a humility and a respect for what in Buddhism is called interdependent origination or arising, to really appreciate the degree to which what we think and what we feel and what we want, hope and dream and suffer and all the rest of it is deeply embedded in a field of relationships.
And a couple thousand years of what we now have come to think of as mindfulness makes us mindful of the mind and the role it plays. And Alva writes a great deal, Alva Noe writes a great deal about consciousness here. He says it's more like dancing than digestion. We make it, and not only that, but consciousness is like money, sort of like a dollar bill. I like these metaphors.
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually mean to say that that consciousness is like money, but it's like money to this extent. No matter how refined your microscope is, you're not going to discover the value of a dollar bill by examining it under that microscope. And in the same way, I don't think, however much we refine our new brain imaging technologies, we're going to be able to find the consciousness happening in the brain. We'll find all sorts of neural events that correlate to consciousness. We'll find all sorts of neural events whose occurrence is necessary for consciousness. But ultimately, the consciousness is something that happens to animals that have brains, but also bodies, and are in situations and are dynamically interacting with the world. Looking for consciousness in the brain alone is like looking for the dance of the dancer and the musculature of the dancer alone. And let me go back to this.
Can't separate the dancer from the dance, as long as we're talking about poets, metaphysical poets. That's Yeats.
Oh, is it? Okay, yeah. Good. You can't separate the dancer from the dance, and nor, to leave the quotation, nor can you separate the dancer from nor can you separate the dance from the music or the landscape in which the dance is occurring. It's a complex, dynamic
cultural
activity.
Environment, all of the habitat.
Exactly. And I just want to pick up on something Rick said that is very important, this idea that we sculpt our brains through experience. I think that's exactly right. We do now know, and we understand very clear looking at the human brain, but also at the brains of other mammalian species, that the functional organization of the brain is determined to a very great deal by non-genetic factors, that is, by epigenetic factors, by experience, by what actually happens from the time of conception. But what's interesting then is one might then just as well have said that the world sculpts the brain as that anything else sculpts the brain. The brain is like our internal hand, and my external hand is calloused and shows all the signs of the guitar playing or baseball playing or whatever it is, or writing. The callus is on my writing hand. And likewise, our internal brains are shaped and calloused and worked by the use to which we put it.
You mentioned Francis Crick, in fact, when he brought out that book that said we're all neurons and that's all we are, he was on the air with us and so forth. And this is pretty much something that you're moving away from and the cognitive science is moving away from.
Well, I hope it's moving away from it. I do fear that idea has a stranglehold on us. You know, Crick said that you, your thoughts, your feelings, your joys, your personalities, your wishes, all of that is nothing but the action of a vast assembly of brain cells and their associated molecules. And then he added, really very remarkably, he added with a sort of a flourish, that this claim of his is so astonishing so foreign to the thinking of most people alive today that it can truly be called astonishing. That's almost an exact quote. But the thing is, the thing that's really astonishing about it is how astonishing it isn't. That's a very orthodox view. Inside of each of us, there is a thing that thinks and feels and decides. In the olden days, a philosopher like Descartes, who was a leading visionary of his time, thought that that thing inside us, which thinks and feels and decides, must be an immaterial something, a soul stuff. And in part that was because Descartes didn't understand how mere matter could possibly do that work. Now, Francis Crick, and I mention him just because he was one of the champions of the new neuroscience of consciousness, he comes along and says, no, that thing inside you that thinks and feels and decides is not something immaterial, it's something material, and in fact, it's the brain. But the fact of the matter is, and here's the sticking point that I think we really need to appreciate, is that, you know, however many hundreds of years it is after Descartes, we do not today actually have a better understanding how the brain gives rise to consciousness than Descartes understood how an immaterial soul something gave rise to consciousness.
Yeah, I think as you say at one point, the only thing we know for sure is we don't have a clue.
There's real agreement about that. We don't even have a good back of the envelope sketch of what a good theory is going to look like. And that's not to say that we don't know an awful lot about the neurological basis of consciousness, cognition, and the unconscious.
But we can't explain the mind in terms of the brain, which is, I think, a point that you really bring about quite lucidly and importantly. Also reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from Mark Twain, which is about age. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. It's mind over matter, in other words. cognitive habits grow in response to our needs and interests. Then, Rick Hansen, do we really have control over them? I mean, this is sort of the argument one reads in Alvin Noe's book.
Well, I think that...
Because you're saying we can use all this great knowledge that we have now cognitively, bring about wisdom and bring about compassion and all the kind of things that the Buddha emphasized.
I think that there's a lot of evidence that different aspects of the neural substrate of the brain and the nervous system broadly are very intimately correlated with variations in how we think and feel and act and hope and dream and suffer and treat other people well or badly. I think the larger point, though, is that what it is that leads that neural substrate to change in the ways that it does that are so intimately correlated with the changes in the mind, both conscious and unconscious, is embedded in a much larger web of causes and conditions than just inside the, you know, the body bag, as Alan Watts described it, alone. So in terms of that, the opportunity increasingly is to actually, through deliberate mental activity, take responsibility for, really, the 3 pounds of tofu between our ears. And rather than feel just willy-nilly pushed around by world events that seem so overwhelming to so many of us, as well as by our reactions to them, then instead of that, gradually feel at home inside our own nervous system and increasingly a kind of nudger, if you will, gradually nudging, you know, the neural structures in an increasingly positive direction. But I think the opportunity there is to do that increasingly skillfully.
You got to nudge particularly because you see this from an evolutionary standpoint. It goes back to all this arousal we had, yeah, you know, thousands of years ago. We have to control that somehow, as you're saying.
Yeah, I think really appreciating the ways in which the evolutionary currents have given us a home base that I think is characterized by what I call the 3 C's, you know, calm, contented, and caring. Actually, it's the 5 C's that includes conscious and creative. I mean, that's our home base. But evolution has also given us circuits, to use that kind of languaging, hopefully it's not too reductionistic, that drive us from home at the crack of a twig or a cough of a leopard or some face on Fox News. And now that we're armed with nuclear weapons, you know, caveman brains and all the rest, I just think that it's pretty important to appreciate the degree to which those evolutionary inheritances in our own nervous system need to be seen through, tamed, managed, and transcended in some ways.
Then move toward happiness, love, and wisdom, which sounds like utopia.
I mean a very practical one. As someone said earlier to me on the phone on the way here, life is imperfectible. You know, perfecting the mind is like polishing Jell-O. You know, you just can't do it ultimately. I think suffering will always be with us. But we can make this world a better place, and we can make our own lives better ones.
Who is Donald Held, by the way, who said neurons fire together, they can wire together?
Great Canadian psychologist. So I want to shout out for Canada and psychologists. Hebb was great. He was ahead of his time, and basically no one quite understood how experience did sculpt neural structure, even in the late 40s and early 50s. studies, which puts the changes in neuroscience really in perspective. And he came along and he said that neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, fleeting mental activity, which is correlated with fleeting neural activity, leaves lasting residues behind.
Alvin Noe, see it that way, as a philosopher and as someone who has studied the cognitive sciences? Because I keep thinking about set points. I keep thinking that so many of us have temperaments and set points emotionally and so forth. And if we're re-sculpting our brain to give ourselves greater compassion, greater sensitivity, you know, whatever you what you will, we got to get over those set points, or we have to make them more flexible or pliable.
You know, Hebb's point concerns how to think about the establishment of linkages in the brain. But you can just extend that point. Think about, you know, when people, you know, couples that argue together, keep arguing together. And one of the things that I try to look at in my book is so often when we think about the mind and consciousness, we look at our powers of thought, our powers of representation, our powers of reason. But one of the things I try to give pride of place in the book is the role of habit. You know, roboticists have been trying to make intelligent robots, but I don't think they're going to succeed in making robots that are anything like us until they make robots with habits like us. Think of the way you take the same route to work every morning, or in your house, the same route to the kitchen and then back to the couch, or whatever it might be. Habits are the sort of the foundation for our ability to do anything new. We sort of have to first sort of master our domain before we can try to push a little bit farther out. So one of the points I would make in response to what Rick said is that these circuits that Rick was talking about, well, they're not just in the brain. They include the landmarks and the bits of environment around us that we use to kind of scaffold our being. Our being, you know, where do you stop and where does the rest of the world around you begin? I think it's one of the messages of my book is that it's a prejudice to think that the skull is the critical boundary. We are actually hugely distributed into the world around us. We couldn't be what we are if not for the way the world around us is. Let me give you just a simple example.
I'm just wondering, because what Rick said about the taxi cab drivers who learn those routes or the meditating, it strengthens the brain. And the brain, we keep being told that we use so little of our brain power, whatever our brain might be, that we use, you know, a fairly insignificant amount of it. So it can constantly strengthen and get much more expansive. It's capacious, really.
What I find is interesting about the cab driver is, now I can't actually point to a study that supports this, but I would bet that the following is true, that the way the cab driver navigates is something he can do behind the wheel of the cab. If you take him in his bed and ask him to describe the way, he might not be able to do it. A lot of our abilities to function are online. We make use of landmarks. We know when we're in the face of this landmark, you know, St. Paul's Cathedral in downtown London, we go left because we're trying to get to whatever it is we're trying to get to. But if you remove the landmarks, if you remove the embedding in a situation, it becomes all of a sudden very, very difficult to function.
We're talking with a couple of local thinkers who are here in studio with us. Rick Hansen, who has written a book called Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, which was written with Richard Mendius, who is an MD, with a foreword by Daniel Siegel and prefaced by our friend Jack Kornfield, and Alvin Noe, who has written Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness, which was just recently nominated for a Northern California Book Award, which I informed Professor Noe of when he walked into the studio. Didn't even know. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You may join us if you have something that you'd like to contribute to this discourse. We would certainly welcome hearing from you. In fact, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius, please become part of this conversation. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program. Our lines are open to you, 866-733-6786, from wherever you're listening or however. You can also join us by email, and our email address is simply forum@kqed.org, or you can post a comment on our website by simply visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Rick Hansen with us in studio. Alvin Noe with us in studio. When we return, we'll hear from you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about, well, consciousness, still looking in neuroscience for a unified field theory of consciousness, but also talking about your brain, your mind, and what you can do about it, such as it is, and really how to envision it, how you can shape the brain and ways of learning from new neuroscience. Alvin Noe here with us in studio is a writer, philosopher, professor in the Department of Philosophy at UC Berkeley and author of Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness. And Rick Hansen, who is a neuropsychologist and author of Buddha's Brain, the Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. He's a trustee of Saybrook University, and the book was written with Richard Mendius, and also co-founder, that is, Rick Hansen is a co-founder of Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience. You were going to say something in response to something Professor Noe said, Rick. What was that?
Right. Well, building on what Alvin Noe was saying, it makes me think about levels of explanation. In other words, one level of explanation for the mind, let's define that as here, let's say, conscious experiencing, is, I think, legitimately within the nervous system. On the other hand, I think that's a very incomplete level of explanation. And it's a little bit like trying to explain the behavior of rabbits in a meadow with a hawk circling overhead, strictly with resort to their biochemistry. In other words, it makes sense to talk about the biochemistry of rabbits in a field, if you will, but you can't really understand the behavior of rabbits in a field or whatever it is that they experience as mammals very akin to us by strictly resorting to the lowest level of explanation in terms of biochemistry or going even deeper, let's say, into molecular biology or quantum physics. That said, I do think that the level of explanation of neurology has been very useful. It's revolutionized psychotherapy in many ways in the last 10, 20 years. And I think many people find that they're more motivated to treat themselves better and treat other people better when they really come to appreciate how what they do leaves lasting residues in the brains of themselves and other people. On the other hand, thinking about wider nets and larger levels of explanation, it's also true that one of the most effective ways to sculpt your own brain in positive ways is to treat other people well so they treat you well in turn. In other words, to set up dynamic feedback loops in the world in which the world sculpts your brain, if you will, in a better way.
Alvin Noe.
I'm very sympathetic to much of what's just been said. The question I ask myself in my work is you know, what makes consciousness happen? How do we think? How do we feel? How does the world show up for us? And where can we look for an explanation? And what I've been struck by negatively is that no explanation will be complete that looks at the brain alone, that we need, for there to be a science of the mind, it needs to be a contextual science. It needs to be a science of embedding, a science of the situation. And in that sense, it needs to be a higher order science. So going with this levels of explanation idea, mind is a sort of a property. Mind is an achievement of whole animals and persons living with others in worlds. And I mean, just to give a little example to make it more concrete, if I try to sit here and do a long division problem, I need to write it down. I need to use the pencil and the paper to calculate my answer. Well, I would say that those pencil and paper are functioning as part of my cognitive machinery for the purposes of that operation. And I think we underestimate the extent to which that's true, the extent to which we offload our capacities on the world around us, to which our abilities to think and reason and imagine and even dream depend on the availability to us of others.
Let's go to your calls. So we begin with Genevieve. Good morning.
Good morning. The question I have is my sister-in-law just suffered aneurysm of the anterior communicating artery, and forward to that is the corpus callosum. And we are traveling back to see her in a few days to be with her and to be in her environment, and I'm wondering how much can we help her develop new memories and a sense of consciousness?
Well, no, I don't think either my guests are neuroanatomists, but some suggestions, because we're talking about sculpting the brain here for people who've had strokes or who have memory loss.
I don't know the particulars of the situation, of course, but I think that first and foremost, it's really useful to reduce stress. Stress and stress hormones are corrosive to the brain. So to the extent possible, this is your sister, right?
My sister-in-law.
Yeah, to help your sister-in-law just be as calm as possible and as hopeful as possible, and also to have compassion for herself to the extent you can reach her in that way. Or also, I would have to say, very consistent with what Alva's been saying, do not underestimate the impact on her of your own attitude. In other words, your own calm, your own compassion for yourself, your own support for the people around you, including the medical staff who are really trying to help out. All of that gets conveyed in ways that are understood and many ways that are not well understood to your sister-in-law in ways that probably will be helpful to her and certainly couldn't cause harm.
Good luck to you and to her, Genevieve, and thank you for the call. And here's a listener who writes, from a biologist's point of view, it seems to me that Professor Noe's view is actually very orthodox, despite what he says. Would anyone deny that we are brains and bodies and that what our bodies do is part of who we are? Would anyone say that we are radically disconnected from the world? Is there some uniquely philosophical problem lurking around here that Professor Noe hopes to answer? To the extent that anything can be learned from the biology of consciousness, experimentation and meta-analyses let biology speak for itself. Why do we need to learn the lessons of the biology of consciousness from a philosopher?
Well, I'm just doing the best I can. The truth is that I actually the subtitle of my book is
You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness.
Exactly. So I think the biology does speak for itself. Interestingly, cognitive neuroscience is, to a surprising extent, an intellectual backwater. Cognitive neuroscience, or the neuroscience of consciousness, tends, I think, very much to still be trapped in a strange, ultimately abiological view, according to which for every experience, there is an event in the brain whose occurrence is alone sufficient for the experience. And I recommend the writer of the email to just take a look at what's going on in journals of neuroscience of consciousness to see that that is actually a very serious view out there.
Let's go to more of your calls. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning. I'm actually a teacher in a classroom and working on my master's in teaching. And my thesis for my master's program is neuroscience applied to the classroom, teaching and education of children. One of the things I'm finding is that there's a major lack of neuroscience applied and implemented in the field of teaching, child development, educational design. My questions are why, who is working to apply the findings to the field of education and teaching, and what resources would you recommend?
Can anybody help him here? Rick Hansen? Yeah.
I think your question is very well taken. I'm someone who often works with children and has worked a fair amount in schools. And
I
think we're at the
Spirit Rock, right?
Actually, in school districts and other situations as well. What I think, you're right, we're at the very beginning of this. In terms of resources, I would suggest, first of all, people that are working in the executive functions, in terms of the cognitive aspects of helping children, that is an area where I do think there is some good work that's being done in terms of applying in the classroom skillful means from the neuropsychology of the executive functions. The other thing is, you probably know, there's a wonderful organization called Mindfulness in Education that's starting to bring mindfulness practices into the classroom as well, which are very rested in the neuropsychological research on how attention and awareness work.
Alvin Noe.
Yeah, I'd just like to add with the caveat that I'm not somebody with any special training in sort of pedagogy or classroom issues, but
you are a classroom teacher. So.
I've spent the last 20 years working in university classrooms, and I have children. But one of the points that I'd like to say is we don't just think with our brains. Thinking is not something we do inside our heads. We think with our hands and we think with our eyes. We explore when we read, we move our eyes. When we listen, we move our heads and our bodies, and when we solve problems, we do so usually with our whole bodies. And I think it's very important in the classroom to realize that the account of the intelligent life of a child is going to be a picture of a child who's free to move and actively engage with the tools around him or her.
Let me thank Daniel and wonder how you respond, Alva Noe, to this email from Bridget, who says, "A key to a fulfilled life is inspiration, thus achieving states not weighted in the emotions, such as happy and positive thinking, because for as much time as one spends in a high, such as happy, we experience the same amount of time in the complementary opposite state, sad in this case. Can you address how to balance the highs and lows of our lower mind, our physical bodies, transcending those emotions, escaping space-time for at least a few moments every day, and therefore experiencing our higher mind, love, our soul, our life spark?" Actually, probably maybe in some ways more a question for you, Rick Hansen, but feel free here.
Well, I would like to say that that those terms, those emotional terms, are not exactly the terms I used to think about this, but I think that my perspective can speak to this. I think of our conscious lives as something that we achieve. When you teach me a language, you teach me new tools to achieve access to new features of the world around me, the meanings and thoughts and feelings of people who live in that language. And in that way, you allow me to expand my consciousness. Expanding consciousness, which sounds like a sort of a hippie slogan, is something that we can literally do by learning and by acquiring new skills. This actually speaks to the question of the previous caller regarding education in schools. Now, learning new skills is hard work. It's not always an upper. Sometimes it's a downer. It's a struggle. But what we achieve is new worlds. I think that actually the fundamental, if you like, modality of human experience is access. We achieve access. We enable the world to open up to us. The world becomes available to us thanks to what we know and we can do. And that's both a source of exhilaration and stimulation, but of work and struggle.
Rick Hansen?
I think there's a place for so-called negative experiences. You know, I think anxiety about genuine threats out there, not living in the paranoid trance, threat level orange that evolution and political forces often drag us into. But there is a place for being aware of real threats out there or, you know, the sorrow that opens the heart. On the other hand, walking down the street, I don't think there's any shortage of negative experiences in the world. And if a person is interested in developing more happiness for themselves and more kindness for others, both because of personal benefit and also because it benefits other people, then I think there are, if you will, different levels of explanation or different domains of intervention. I mean, one place to intervene is certainly in terms of one's own personal internal mental processes.
Yeah, you argue for self-compassion, which is a very important point, I think.
Yeah,
Not only empathy for others, but empathy for oneself and not being too harsh on oneself, although so much of what you say seems to boil down to kind of attitude and cognitive feelings, call them feelings for lack of a better word. That is, Norman Vincent Peale told us the power of positive thinking. When we go back to that, we're talking about something that is nevertheless real. In fact, a listener who says, about 3 years ago, I conquered uncontrollable negative thinking by learning to live my life in the present moment. In so doing, my thoughts about problems in my past and future lost their power over me. This process revolutionized my life at the age of 64. Eckhart Tolle's book, The Power of Now, helped me achieve this breakthrough. He wants to know what you both think of Eckhart Tolle.
Well, I'd actually like to know the answer to that question. I don't. My 8-year-old son told me yesterday that he has trouble sleeping at night because he gets thoughts in his head and he can't get them out of his head, and often some scary thought about something he heard on the news. He's complaining about images of suicide bombers, which he hears about on the news as an 8-year-old child. And I was actually at a loss driving with him to school yesterday. What could I possibly say to him to get him out of that? The one thing I could think to say...
A philosopher at a loss?
I was at a loss, because the one thing I could think to say to him is, don't be afraid of the thoughts. You can't ban the thought. If you ban the thought, it will come back. Open yourself to the thought and then let it pass, and then the next thought will come.
That's good wisdom, because I think Rick Hansen, who is a psychologist, would say, if you said, just suppress the thought or repress the thought, you're headed for problems, right?
That's right. It's definitely going to come back, right? I do think that a lot of it boils down to intention, in a way, and I think intention is very situated in the world and in an active, embodied kind of way of dealing with our lives, just as Alvin Noe was saying here. And it's also, how can I put a key here as well, is being active for ourselves. One thing I see continually is people are not on their own sides. You know, they're not for themselves. I don't mean that they're against others. They're just not for themselves, and that's where we have to begin, right? And I think one place to begin with that is to really appreciate the actual care that is that does exist for oneself with other people.
There is a notion that Freud had. I don't want to be too arcane here, but he called it moral masochism, the desire unconsciously to punish yourself without even realizing that that's what you're doing.
Right.
I think even if you don't put much credence in Freud, it makes sense. There are those of us who do that.
But there does seem to be something to this. I want to come back to this notion of habit. Just as we have, you know, the habits that govern the way we shop and the way we drive to work, we have habits that govern our thought processes. And one of the things that I've sort of come to believe flowing out of my work as a philosopher and cognitive scientist is that there's a tremendous value both in breaking habits, in changing your job every once in a while, or in doing things that sort of that disrupt the habits and force you to become plastic again, whether it's neurally plastic or in some other way.
John Barth used to say, if you don't think you have free will, if you sleep on the left side of your bed, sleep on the right side of your bed. You'll see what happens. You know, you can at least empower yourself with the idea that you do have that kind of choice. Let me get more callers on. John, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Yeah, I was interested in your guest's comment about how stress is corrosive. And I wonder if they could talk about the ability of stress to actually corrode the brain, if you will, to irreparable damage of the negative feedback stress management loops. Are your guests acquainted with Bruce McEwen's work in stress medicine, in particular his concept of allostatic load, and also his view and Damasio's view is the brain is not just a bunch of neurons, but is a neuroendocrine organ. The nervous system and the endocrine system are inextricably linked. And there does seem to be cases, especially Iraq war vets, who just come back so distressed, so corroded, if you will, by their horrific battle experiences. They just, it's labeled post-traumatic stress disorder, but the direct symptoms are terrible insomnia. They can't sleep. They don't respond to any of the drugs. Antidepressants are coming under some pretty skeptical scrutiny. Anyway, if they could just talk about how stress can, if it reaches a certain tipping point.
No, Rick Hansen, you had talked about the corrosiveness of stress. Are you familiar with some of the,
yes,
the concepts that the caller is talking about? Yeah.
Yeah, I would make two points about it. The first is that we evolved to handle acute bursts of stress, but we did not evolve to handle chronic low-grade or even chronic moderate or high levels of stress, such as people experience who are, for example, serving long tours of duty in war zones. And the effects of that are literally corrosive in terms of, as the caller said, the endocrine system, the hormones such as cortisol, which actually over time increasingly sensitize the amygdala, which is the alarm bell in the brain, and also, unfortunately, gradually over time, eat away at the hippocampus, which helps form memories and puts the brakes on the amygdala. So in other words, it turbocharges our reactions and makes us less able to track the context in which we're getting over-aroused, which then creates vicious cycles. The second point I'd like to make, though, is really one of hopefulness. In other words, there is a vast and growing body of research, in part driven by the interest in helping people with PTSD from many sources, including from experiences at war, that can actually be used to help people deal with the effects of chronic stress and gradually change their own brain over time. And I'd have to say that, again, very consistent with what Alvin Noe has been saying, one of the main sources of that healing of the brain is relationships and nature. The two together can actually produce a very lasting effect in terms of recovering from stress.
And Alva, you kept talking about habits. Sometimes there's a kind of relief of stress that comes through the habitual. That is, you know, when I take out the garbage and I go through recycling and all of the sorts of things week after week, there's a feeling of almost a kind of allaying of stress in a strange way. It's a comforting feeling because it's habitual.
That's right. Imagine if every time you woke up in the morning you needed to decide where to put your feet. That would be very stressful. That would be very difficult if you needed to decide which way to go. We can only function because we don't have to decide that. I wanted to mention in response to the caller, I'm no expert on this kind of traumatic stress, but something I have thought a little bit about and was discussed very beautifully in a book by a psychiatrist named Bruce Wexler is the effects of immigration, in particular forced immigration, but not only forced migration. Think about it. You could grow up in a little village in China, and in that village you're a great raconteur and you're the life of the party and you're sort of charming and debonair, and then you're forced through migration and you end up in a country where you're surrounded by people who don't speak your language. You all of a sudden, all of the social structures and institutions that enable you to be the kind of person you are gone. That's very stressful. That's deeply traumatic, actually. On my view, to lose your environment is to suffer a trauma. And when you consider how many people move in this world, how many people are forced through war or poverty or famine or earthquake or devastation to change where they live. My own parents came to this country. My father came to this country as a Jewish refugee from the Second World War. You think of the kind of life-shaping traumas that those are. I think one of the keys is to look about reconstructing environments to help people be at home in those environments.
Well, we're talking about habit and brain structure, and here's a listener who raises a provocative question. Has anyone looked at how repeated daily prayers, such as Muslims praying five times a day every day, affect brain structures?
I don't know of any research on Muslim or Islamic prayer. On the other hand, it is interesting that people who do routine Buddhist practices clearly do tend to change brain structures. And I'm also thinking about a study that was done on Carmelite nuns in Montreal who were doing a very passionate, prayerful, loving joining with Christ. And on the one hand, some of the same brain regions lit up in their heads, but also other brain regions lit up as well that are kind of informative about the nature of the experience, particularly ones that were more emotionally rewarding.
Here's a listener, Alvinoe, who says, questions to you. What is it about our situated consciousness that makes it so difficult to overturn deeply held assumptive models? For instance, the Cartesian model we live from now seems so difficult to overturn for the model you are advocating. Is there something about your model that empowers the transformation in thinking about the mind for which you are arguing?
That's a great question. One thing I can say by way of an answer is it seems to be very difficult for the philosophical intelligence and very difficult for the neuroscientific intelligence. But I've been spending a lot of my time lately working with dancers and artists. In fact, I actually have recently taken up a position as a philosopher in residence with a ballet theater. And when I tell these dancers some of my ideas, they look at me with astonishment that I think I have anything to say. It's the oldest news in the book about, yeah, your body is important. Yeah, the environment matters. So I think there's many walks of life, if you're an architect or a designer or an artist or a dancer, where a sort of a more distributed, integrated, active
conception. They don't have to muse or ruminate on it. They just do it, right?
And they understand it. Yeah. Right. So it does seem to be, you know, in one of the other sort of features of this intellectual tradition that I'm responding against is this idea that a human being is in the first instance a deliberator. We are a reasoner. We are detached, and we look and we plan and we act. And against that, there's this idea that we're in the flow, we're engaged, we're like soccer players in midfield. The soccer player doesn't need to decide, what is that? Oh, it's a ball. Rather, the soccer player is immediately wrapped up in a project, and that project as much determines what the soccer player is going to do as any decision-making that the soccer player might make as we go along.
Well, apropos of that, a listener wants to know what you think about the idea of being in the zone in sports. What's his name, the psychologist with the unpronounceable name?
Chikmhaley, sort of.
Csikszentmihalyi, I mean, really talks about that sense of being in the zone, and it's real to many athletes and dancers and so forth. I mean, they say they actually feel it. Here's Tim from Berkeley who writes, the mind is not the brain, is not the same as the Buddhist no-self. Rather, it's saying the mind is a process. It does not equal the gray matter. To say that if we're not seeing the mind itself in the nervous system, it doesn't exist is simply materialism.
And neither of us are interested in
that. No, I don't think anybody's saying
that.
Do the authors have anything to say? AJ writes about the construction of consciousness by the developing brain mind of an infant as she interacts with the world, including the social world.
Well,
actually, we had a psychologist on from Berkeley.
Alison Gopnik?
Yes. Thank you. Who has that whole thesis built around how infants see the world and take everything in almost like, well, obviously like new, but in ways that we can't even neurologically imagine or our brains don't even function with.
Yeah. One of the things that I think it's important that we realize is that the newborn child is not, to use a phrase that Allison once used, a scientist in the crib trying to figure out what's going on in the world around it. The child is born into a relationship, and the child doesn't need to guess on the basis of what the mother is saying and doing that the mother is actually another mind. The mother's other mind is sort of presupposed, I think, by the very first experiences that the child has. So I think I would say, and here I think this would probably be very much in sympathy with a sort of a psychotherapeutic approach, that even when looking at the development of a child, it's important to think about the dyadic child caretaker relationship that gives the initial environment to the child.
Let's get Cheryl on from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I wanted to ask Rick Hansen a question. Rick, I'm a facilitator in the Institute of the Work with Byron Katie, and that Katie's method is to use inquiry to help people question negative thoughts that cause them to suffer and to find what's truer for them. So Katie talks about the order of creation of a thought. A thought causes a feeling that causes us to act a certain way and to get us a result. So my question is, if I'm intentional about my thinking, and, for example, if I ask myself each morning, what's the result I want to create today, what would I need to think and feel to get that result, and what behaviors would I need to take to get that result, how am I changing my brain and my neural pathways? Is that going to help me become a happier person?
Right. If I get you right, in part, you're asking a question about what's sometimes called rehearsal. For, in other words, anticipating activities, particularly, let's say, with a positive anticipated reward, which will increasingly motivate you to go in that direction. Without a doubt, you know, neurons that fire together wire together, for better or worse. And if you are anticipating your day and thinking about the good things that will come from certain kinds of intentions, you're definitely inclining yourself in a certain way. It is interesting, actually, that one study I think about pianists, they took two groups of experienced pianists and they had one group play a piece that involves certain finger movements, let's say half an hour a day, and they had another group of pianists just simply imagine playing the piece for, again, half an hour a day that involved these particular esoteric and specific finger movements. And then they looked at their brains under the scanner, and they found that both groups had roughly equally built out portions of the sensory motor strips of the brain that were involved with those particular arcane finger movements. In other words, mental activity, even rehearsed mental activity, really changes structure. The thing that I would say, though, again, very consistent, I think, with this conversation here, is that very often feelings create thoughts, or body sensations create thoughts, relationships create thoughts. Embedded and active, you know, encounters with the world, you know, create thoughts.
Thoughts create feelings, and feelings create thoughts.
Yeah, in a wonderful circular way. I think there's a whole brand of research right now called embodied cognition, which really appreciates the degree to which of the felt, embodied, enacted sense of experiencing really shifts and underpins what we've previously thought about as simply abstract intellectual activity.
And remember that if you didn't have fingers, that those cortical areas that support the use of the fingers would change in their organization. They would, through not receiving nervous stimulation from the fingers, they would take on new functions, and that would lead to a sort of a plastic reorganization. So though it's true that one can exercise your finger-moving skills offline, it all takes place in the background of an actual finger-using, finger-possessing situation.
But as we come to the end of the hour, let's say it firmly, absolutely, the brain is not like a computer. It is like a computer, and it's not like a computer.
It's not like a computer.
Let me thank you both. It's been a pleasure, and it certainly has been enlightening. Rick Hansen's book, again, is Buddha's Brain, and Alvin Noe's book is Out of Our Heads, Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness. Thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Appreciate your listenership. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.